This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Sales tax revenue became a big issue in the recent municipal elections in Bloomington Normal, and it will keep on being one as cities across the nation adjust to new realities.
Places like Cleveland, Ohio, they're not going to plow residential streets anymore. You know, it's up to you to get to the collector street. We'll plow the collectors, but we can't afford to plow residential streets. Colorado Springs, Colorado, turned the streetlights off. We're not going to have streetlights. They quit mowing their parks. If you want to enjoy the park, bring your mower.
Normal City Manager Mark Peterson says there's not a lot of innovation yet in how cities deal with sales tax declines. Plus, hear from the head of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. We'll also take a look at the new hire at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, a whopping $33 million expansion at Westminster Village, and the centennial of the start of World War I. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. One of Bloomington Normal's largest and oldest senior living centers is embarking on an ambitious expansion. Westminster Village in Bloomington has cut the ribbon on efforts to spruce up and grow its campus on the south side of Bloomington. CEO Barb Nathan says the project will take $33 million to accomplish.
The areas being expanded are in several different locations around our campus, but primarily are creating another entrance off of Mercer, and an entrance building there. We are doing additions on common spaces, being dining and other residence spaces, and then doing an expansion on Martin Hill Center, which is our skilled care facility. And following that expansion, we'll come back through and renovate all of the existing. So we're not only adding beds, but we are changing our model of care. So it will be private rooms, small neighborhoods, things that add more personalized, resident-directed care.
How many beds will you add?
We're adding 18 skilled beds and changing to 80 private rooms and 8 semi.
How does this meet the needs of the population?
It does meet the needs of the population, especially the enlarging our common spaces as well, is in the subsequent phases to this one, we'll build a new assisted living building and add memory support. That will end up being where our current front entrance is. That's why we're moving an entrance. So that will add people to the community, and then we'll come back and renovate the space that is currently occupied by assisted living. So altogether, we're going to add about 100 to 120 residents to the campus.
Over what period of years?
Probably over the next 7 years.
Well, what are the demographic trends? I mean, we've been in the middle of the aging of the baby boomers for a long time. When does that end?
Well, the first baby boomers will probably enter a world like Westminster in about another 10 years. So that's part of the reason. But Westminster is very, very blessed to have over 300 people on our waiting list today. So that's a combination of people that believe they'll want to move to Westminster within the next couple of years and others that see it a little bit further down the road, but it's their plan to live here. So that's in many ways our driving force for this expansion.
How many people are coming directly from Bloomington Normal to Westminster, and how many are coming from, say, a retirement home in Florida or Arizona or someplace like that, and then coming back to the community?
Yeah, you know, it's probably the majority of our residents are either living in Bloomington Normal or McLean County. They may be wintering elsewhere, or they may have relocated for a period of time. That's a relatively small number. But there's a significant number. It's still a small percentage, but probably 10 to 20% who have not lived in Bloomington Normal, but their kids lived here. So they're moving to be closer to children.
Fundraising. How's this being paid for?
Well, this is actually, we are doing financing for this phase and are in the process. There's been several areas we've been working on. We've, of course, been working on design. We've been working through approvals. That included the state approval for the expansion of skilled care, and we secured that. And we've been working through financing. We qualify for tax-exempt financing because we're not-for-profit. And so we're working through that process and anticipate that will close in May.
What about the timing of the construction?
Most of the common spaces and new entrants will be done within the first 12 months. There'll be some because we're moving an area to another area that we won't do the subsequent renovation till the following 6 months. And Martin Health Center will take about 2 years to complete both the expansion and the renovation.
Barb Nathan is the CEO of Westminster Village, one of the largest senior living communities in Bloomington Normal.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, sales tax troubles. Exploration using three different people who have perspectives on that issue. The City of Bloomington this week hired a 50-year veteran of events management to be the interim director of the Downtown Performing Arts Center. Previous director Tina Salamone passed away suddenly. Carl St. Clair is a semi-retired executive for Venue Works, which also manages the city-owned Coliseum. GLT's Colleen Reynolds talks with City Manager David Hales about the emergency hire. It's not unusual to promote an assistant manager in the interim in such situations, but Hales says after talking it over, the city decided not to do that in this case.
What is their workload? You know, what would have to be sacrificed? Because we already have several vacant positions at the BCPA. Keep in mind, Jay Tetzloff not only overseeing the entire department, also is wearing the other hat of zoo director. So he has been relying on Eric Veal as the assistant to oversee and to assist both cultural arts issues, golf course, parks. And we did have those discussions. But one of our great concerns was, do you have the time? Do you have the capacity to spend what really could very well be a lot of time helping replacing what was a very heavy workload that Tina had? In fact, since her passing, we found out that she was spending many weekends down there in doing a lot of work, and that may have been as a result of not having some of those positions filled. And it was determined that they just didn't have the capacity to spend the kind of time necessary to replace a very hardworking person that was spending, if anything, maybe too much time because of those vacancies. Right now, our immediate concern is how can we make sure that booking of events, especially for the fall season, is moving, and to address, you know, just overall supervision, keep things going.
With some of those vacancies, and the BCPA has been under a microscope of sorts, is this a good time to look at, and it's been raised before, the issue of, do you turn over permanent management? I mean, could this be seen as sort of a test pilot for having Venue Works ultimately take it over?
Well, we're always looking at how we can improve operations, achieve greater cost savings. One thing financially we're looking at is in the budget that the council will consider next week, actually on Monday. Right now, we're projecting about $500,000 operating deficit for the BCPA. So we are concerned about how that has grown in, you know, over the last few years. What can we do to reverse that? What do we do about some of those vacant positions? But also make sure that it continues to be just a great opportunity for the arts and for events. We are going to look at that with someone like Mr. Sinclair and his background, he'll be looking and giving some recommendations. What can we do both in the short term, long term? And I think one thing we feel very good about is VenueWorks does do a lot of booking for many of the performing arts and theaters that they manage. And it's critical that we have that help right now because the late Tina Salamone did most of the booking. And so it we don't have, we're trying to determine just what was kind of established, scheduled for the fall, what we need to finish up on that. So this is a case where VenueWorks personnel can be extremely helpful.
I also noticed that they manage similar size venues, like the Rialto Theater, for example, in Joliet. And could you leverage some of those bookings? You know, people are on their way to Chicago or to Joliet anyway.
Definitely. And in fact, that's what VenueWorks does right now for the Coliseum. They're constantly looking at, as they book shows, how can they, you know, include the Coliseum, you know, in that. And so the same thing can happen with the BCPA and some of the bookings they're making, you know, which is more ideal for the Performing Arts Center than others. So, yes, it's some great synergy is going to occur in this interim. And, you know, we'll be evaluating that. But, you know, some of that has also happened in the past. Even VenueWorks' main booking agent would oftentimes call Tina and convey to her, hey, you know, this is maybe a show you're interested in. We'll be seeing how we can continue that and have Carl, you know, in touch with those booking agents.
Do you have any thoughts or opinions about a direction that you would like to see the management go?
There's no doubt, as the council said time and time again, whether it's the Coliseum, the Performing Arts Center, Pepsi Ice Center, first and foremost, we want to achieve, you know, a high level of financial efficiency and to try to minimize the subsidy as best we can. We're also wanting to look at avoiding duplication, redundancy, which adds to our operating costs. And those efforts will continue. And we'll continue to evaluate them during this short-term period to see what is the best long-term option as we get ready to start that planning for the more permanent long-term solution to the vacant Performing Arts Center manager position.
I'm Colleen Reynolds, and you're listening to Sound Ideas. We're talking with Bloomington City Manager David Hales, who will be bringing the City Council a budget on Monday that projects a $500,000 deficit for the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. $500,000 deficit is a lot. What are you going to say about that when the council starts asking? Mm-hmm. I know that you did a financial audit back when the budget task force was doing its work. And what did that find?
Well, first off, keep in mind that on the budget, we have that deficit, but we also have about three vacant positions. Those haven't been filled yet. Now, the budget is anticipating those positions being filled. In the short term, the immediate, we want to look at those and say, do all those positions need to be filled? Is there anything Mr. St. Clair can recommend to help even in this upcoming budget to reduce that projected deficit?
And then you also have the issue of the Cultural Arts Center and the $1 million that's sitting in a fund waiting for something to happen. What direction do you think that's going to take?
Well, the budget that we're recommending to the council does utilize about $1 million of those funds that were donated in the past for the Cultural District and the Creativity Center. We're proposing in this budget to utilize $1 million for two critical building improvements. One is to put a new roof on the Creativity Center, and the other is to grade and replace the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system. That's what's planned, hopefully for this summer and fall, as soon as we can get going, which then will leave not very much money left in the that particular savings account. And then it's further discussion about, okay, how do you begin to raise the money for the ultimate renovation of the Creativity Center?
And is that something that this council will decide as a policy about, do we want to move forward with that? Or is that assumed?
Well, the council several months ago, or earlier this year, did make a policy statement that they were committed to the Creativity Center. However, there was differing opinions about the approximate $5 million price tag for total renovation of the Creativity Center. Is, well, how's that to be raised? Is that from the private sector through donations? Is it from the public sector? Is it kind of a combination from both, like we're funding some of the zoo improvements? That is yet to be decided. But I'm sure in this upcoming year, part of our five-year capital improvement plan, that'll definitely be a policy decision the council will have to make to get guidance both to the Friends of the BCPA, which is a fundraising agency, and to help BCPA management understand what the plan is for funding renovating Creativity Center after we finish the roofing and the HVAC work.
Is that something you think Mr. St. Clair can help you with in terms of maybe analyzing what the capacity for support, private support, would be? And maybe making a recommendation for later?
Possibly, but he's going to be extremely busy on a day-to-day basis just dealing with continuing to make sure all the events currently scheduled are properly supported, and also getting the shows for the fall up and going. But even in several meetings I've had with him, he has a lot of ideas of how he has assisted in making operations more efficient, raising money, capital campaigns, and so forth. So during the limited time he's here, we really want to have him give us all the ideas and to benefit from the experience he's had across the nation in helping manage performing arts centers like ours.
Sounds like 4 months is a short amount of time, and that he's got some great expertise. I'm almost hearing in your voice that, boy, we'd like to keep him a little bit longer.
It all depends. I mean, again, he's not looking for a long-term engagement. He's past the career where he's been doing this full-time, so it just all depends. And plus, we don't know what we're going to find when we look at recruiting, say, for a full-time BCPA manager. I know in the past here, I've gone through two transitions in management up there, and it is tough sometimes to find the right person. So, you know, once we get past the first 2 or 3 months and look to the future, we'll just have to see, you know, what opportunities or what other problems we might have in trying to come up with that long-term solution for management of the cultural arts activities.
Do you expect that you are going to hear some input from council members who might say now is a time to really maybe make that transition to a Venue Works, because you have those open positions anyway, and they may, you know, be able to help figure out how to do without that, or, you know, what's the best mix, and that if you're ever going to do it, now's the time to do it with probably the least amount of pain?
I don't know what I'll hear. There's no doubt that, you know, certain opportunities are presenting themselves at this point in time, but they've also got the entire budget to approve Monday. We do have some work sessions coming up, and as we begin to give them reports of the status of our work on the fall season, I'm sure we'll get some feedback.
Bloomington City Manager David Hales also told GLT's Colleen Reynolds he is not aware that any acts have been finalized for the fall season. He says it is clear that Tina Salamone had many possibilities in play before she passed away and had been working diligently on those. It's unusual for the BCPA to announce, or it is usual for the BCPA to announce its fall season in May, which leaves less than 2 months to finalize perhaps a couple of dozen acts.
Hi, I'm Frank Boyd, a GLT contributing listener. My favorite program on GLT is Morning Edition. I like almost all the programming on GLT, but I'm old school and can't imagine starting my day without it. In fact, my entire adult life, every morning, is begun by listening to Morning Edition as I get ready for work. This is the GLT Fund Drive. Help pay for Morning Edition and everything GLT does with your contribution now. Click on Donate at WGLT.com. GLTcontributing.org.
If you hear us asking for your financial support and think whatever you can afford to give won't matter, you're wrong. Public radio, like GLT, depends on reasonable contributions from thousands of listeners. Every contribution, no matter the amount, matters a lot. Decide how much you can give and contribute now at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at JustinMBoyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, marking the centennial anniversary of the U.S. entry into World War I. Bloomington and Normal city governments are feeling pinched by the technology trend curbing revenues from sales taxes. It's contributed to the announced closure of at least a half a dozen stores in the Twin Cities, including some large department stores such as Goldman's, Macy's, and Penny's. We're going to explore that picture with the next three segments on Sound Ideas. GLT talked with City Manager Mark Peterson of the town of Normal about what he hears from others in his position.
It's a concern of municipalities across the country, and it's a regular topic of conversation when I get together with my colleagues from other communities. Cities and counties in the United States rely heavily on the revenue from retail sales. In the town, same with the city of Bloomington, our single largest revenue source is sales tax. That pays for police, fire, you know, snow removal. Many, many basic services are paid through the sales tax. As we see retail sales, not only locally, but nationally, trending downward, it's a great concern. It's a great concern when we see retailers closing their doors here locally, whether it's in Bloomington or Normal. That's not a good sign, but we are not alone. I understand this phenomenon is happening everywhere. And I think it will probably lead cities at some point to look for different models for funding basic services, or it will require significant reductions in service levels.
Is it just the internet sales tax drain, or is it a lack of consumption in certain sectors as well?
That's a great question, and I have not been able to get a good answer to that. Clearly, the internet is a part of that. There are, you know, documented situations where some bricks and mortar retailers are being hurt by their own internet component, their own internet services. Best Buy is a great example. But I also have to believe that there's some reduction in consumption that's driving it as well. There are certain things that you can't purchase over the internet very, very effectively, and even some of those sectors are slowing down. So I think it's a combination of internet and some reduction in consumption nationally.
Is sales tax going to crater? Is it going to level off at some point, some lower point in the future? What's the thinking?
Well, it's leveling off here. We've seen 2 years of decline, which is very unusual in Bloomington Normal. We have this, you know, longstanding robust economy, and for years we lived on the sales tax, and it treated us very well. It wasn't that long ago that we would see annual increases of 8, 10, 12% in sales tax. I used to tell people it's not too difficult to become debt-free when you have that kind of revenue growth, and we did. Now we are budgeting 1.5 to 2 to 2.5% increases, and we're struggling to hit those numbers. I think there's some other things going on locally. We've lost, you know, a major employer in Mitsubishi. We are losing some employees through State Farm's realignment of their operations. It's clearly had an impact, as well as they have shed a lot of their contract workers, which we knew would happen eventually, but it sort of happened all at once, and it was kind of a jolt to the system. But I still think people are still concerned about the economy and are probably being a little more careful with their spending decisions, particularly on durable type goods that generate a lot of sales tax.
So it's a lot of small incremental adjustments in the local area, not just one big trend.
I think it is small incremental adjustments, not one big trend. But I do think it's a trend that's going to continue. I think the nature of retail is changing, and I think that we are going to see fewer bricks and mortar retail outlets. I think I think internet commerce will continue to grow as it continues to be extremely convenient for people, where you can literally buy anything you can possibly think of and have it delivered to your doorstep in 48 hours with free shipping in some cases and no sales tax. So there's certainly compelling arguments that that's the way to go. But again, that, you know, that has a ripple effect on the economy, because a lot of these, very few of these online retailers, they don't have a retail presence, so they aren't paying local utility bills. They're not paying property taxes. They don't have employees. They don't have a customer service department. They're not sponsoring the Pony League teams, or they're not members of the Chamber of Commerce, and they're not contributing to WGLT and all these other things that, you know, we rely on businesses doing. And that has that ripple effect that changes the nature of the economy. Now, you know, I think it's happening. So we've got to figure out, as municipalities and as communities, how are we going to deal with this change? And we haven't yet.
Are there some think tank cities that are trying to be innovative in coming up with different revenue per service models, or any experimenting so far?
I have not seen any. I have not heard of anybody doing that. I tell you what cities are mostly doing is they're cutting services. They're cutting services because, frankly, raising revenue is very difficult and politically unpopular. And so what you're seeing is places like Cleveland, Ohio, they're not going to plow residential streets anymore. You know, it's up to you to get to the collector street. We'll plow the collectors, but we can't afford to plow residential streets. Colorado Springs, Colorado, turned the streetlights off. We're not going to have streetlights. They quit mowing their parks. If you want to enjoy the park, bring your mower. Radical things like that seem radical, cities are just saying, we can't afford it anymore. We're going to close fire stations. We'd love to have a 5-minute response time, but we're going to live with 8. We're not there yet, but that's what a lot of communities, that's how they're coping with it. They're just cutting services. And, you know, hopefully we have a better answer than that before we have to start cutting back on essential services.
That's City Manager Mark Peterson of the town of Normal. For our next dive into tech trends, e-commerce, and sales tax revenues, let's go to ISU scholar Gary Hunter. Hunter is a professor in the College of Business. He says not all sectors are suffering from internet competition.
I think department stores are probably in particular danger because of just the way they're set up and the amount of competition. If you look at Eastland Mall, for example, you have Bergner's, which is still there, which would be a competitor to Macy's. You have
and the Penney's.
Yeah, yeah.
And you got true. Sears.
Yeah, and you got Sears, which I would put more on the level of Wood Penney's in terms of competition, and Kohl's there. So to a certain extent, it's probably the competition, too.
Where can we expect this to level out?
That's a really good question. I wish I could answer that question. I did take a small poll of the students, which is admittedly a very small sample. But in terms of apparel, anyway, because I was asking them about apparel, they're probably like 80% in-store and 20% online. So, but, you know, that's just for one aspect. There's also consumer electronics, which you would think there would be more online purchases. Yet Best Buy is doing okay at this point.
The Best Buys and the Barnes & Nobles, who are successfully resisting the Amazon juggernaut, according to a lot of business analysts, have done so because they have coupled customer service with a really, really strong web presence. So people can shop online and then go to the store to pick it up, or shop in the store and get some human expertise and then go online and buy it. And from Best Buy's perspective, it matters which platform they buy from, but not as much as you might think. Mm-hmm. Is that the template for survival, or is there another way to leverage human expertise to maintain a bricks and mortar advantage?
Oh, I think service. There's certainly something to be said for the service, but Radio Shack was also known for service. And it hasn't done Radio Shack so well. You do wonder about with the younger generation coming up where communication is all, or it seems to be preferred to be mediated through some electronic device, that is service going to change? Even going to the gas station. When I go to the gas station now, I'd prefer to use the credit card out at the pump as opposed to having to go in and talk to a person. The generation that's here now, I think they tend to be like that all the time.
Even when they might need extra information about a product. You don't need a lot of information about it pumping gas.
True. Very true. But even when they need information about another product, they tend to use, instead of using voice, they would use text. So that would change the way that service is provided. And you'd have to look at how are you going to provide that same degree of rapport and the things that constitute good service in a text as opposed to face-to-face.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with ISU Professor Gary Hunter about the changing retail landscape. In the Town of Normal and City of Bloomington election contest, there have been candidates who've suggested that we might eventually become a nation of specialty shops, so that the mall is dead. What's the scholarship looking like on that, and what are the trends looking like on that?
Well, retail always evolves, and there's times in the past where we've had more department store type retailers, like general stores, if you go back in the past, and that evolved into specialty stores, and then it also brought out, it stretched back out into department stores later, too. So you could talk about it's just a cycle. And that department stores, you know, they're in a valley now, but they may come back later. And really, if you think about it, I mean, Amazon is sort of an electronic department store in itself, just a really large department store. Yeah.
That's ISU Business Professor Gary Hunter. Now, the head of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association says he spends a lot of sleepless nights thinking about the impact of technology. Rob Carr stopped in Normal Thursday to talk to the Economic Development Council. Here is a 10-minute clip of Carr's address to the EDC discussing the future of retail.
Who knows what drones and driverless vehicles will bring, but I guarantee they will bring more change, and they are a lot closer than you may realize. The smartphone has changed and continues to change the customer my members serve every day. And customers increasingly demand highly customized offerings, not only to their email and their web browser, but literally as they wander in and around their stores as they go about their daily routine. I drive down Monroe Street in Springfield to get to the Capitol every morning, and my Starbucks app will remind me about a half mile out that Starbucks, as if I need reminding, is on the left-hand side. And all I have to do is swipe it to the left, and the app pops up, and I scan it, and I leave. No cash changes hands. The customer wants the same sort of customization, ease of service, and interaction that they get on their smartphone at brick-and-mortar stores. You walk down a grocery store aisle for your favorite cereal, you turn into aisle 7 or whatever it is. They expect a coupon if there's one available to shop up for that particular brand of cereal. You can also scan each item that you purchase, and coupons pop up. Some apps will tell you what might be a better buy. The customization started with loyalty programs, and then they moved to radio frequency ID tags. But change now is happening so rapidly that even before they have fully implemented RFID tags, I don't know, does anyone know what RFID tags are? They're these extraordinarily tiny tags that you put in labels or on products, and they send out a very small, short-range signal. But before these are even fully implemented, they're now moving to geolocation information and biometrics. I wonder if you remember this scene from the 2002 movie Minority Report. Tom Cruise is walking through a passageway, if you will, and he and other consumers, as they do so, ads start to pop up that are individualized just for them on these boards. Tom, are you feeling like getting away to Aruba? And the ad pops up. Some lady walks by and wants to know that the ad advertises some sort of wine for her. It's that kind of hyper-customization to which we're ultimately headed. Now, some of us who are a bit older get a little concerned about privacy in those kind of areas. But I guarantee you, the younger generation that's behind us don't even think about it. They don't perceive of privacy the same way you and I, who are a little bit older, might do. And they're willing to trade a little bit of that for the highly customized offerings and the service maximization that it can generate. But if you think about it, they're really nothing more than the natural evolution of the loyalty shopping card perhaps our parents used to carry, depending on your age, you know, the old jewel card that you used to show at the checkout. And not only do customers want this highly personalized experience, they want it instantly available. So brick and mortar stores are trying to adjust to this as well. You can check now to see if an item's in stock, at what store, how soon it will be there if it's not in stock, or how quickly it can be delivered to a location of your choice. You want something even faster? In the not too distant future, I bet you'll be able to produce much of what you want, your own items, using a 3D printer at home. Simply buy the material, program the material, and voila, you have your own customized shoes, shirt, tool, whatever it is you might conceive, manufactured in your home to your exact specifications. But one of the enduring advantages of brick and mortar retail is the opportunity for the consumer to interact directly with a variety of products. And the transition to using this advantage while meeting the consumer where they are is well underway. Pop-up stores are starting to gain traction. So you might not have a Best Buy, let's say, standing in one spot. It may be there for a couple months, and then it will move to another location, maybe within your area and maybe outside of your area. You'll have stores on wheels, much like the old Schwan Food Service. I'm dating myself, I get it, but stick with me. If you go to the farmer's market in Springfield, each week there are some ladies that have purchased a trailer. It's not a very big trailer, but it is not selling any foods, jams, or baked goods. It is selling women's fashion and accessories. They have limited supply, but the supply that they have is a good variety, and it's of excellent quality. And what they don't have, they can order for you. They're bringing the store to you. Those will continue to proliferate, I believe. But brick and mortar will always have, I think, the advantage in whatever form it takes, because there's nothing like the instant gratification of touching or experiencing the product you want, the keywords being at least the first time you buy it. I might want to be able to get my shirt and try it on the first time, but after that, I can go to Brooks Brothers or wherever I might choose to purchase it and buy it online and have it shipped to me. Technology may also quickly eclipse this approach. Companies have developed electronic mirrors and virtual dressing rooms. My experience with this 3 years ago, and they have already moved beyond it, but you stand in front of a mirror, you touch the mirror. You touch color, you touch what you want, and it shows you in that, in my case, a suit, someone else's case, a dress, how you might move, how it moves with you, how it looks. You can change colors, you can add accessories to it. It all occurs in front of you, and it can save your profile, and you can take it with you. You don't want what Macy's has to offer, you go to the next place, and you'll load it into the electronic mirror of the dressing room, and it's done there. I can't tell you what a joy this would have been when my wife and I, with our kids, were much younger, and we were trying to keep them all corralled to have that kind of convenience. But there's no need to grab an armful of clothes to go there, or you might be limited to 3 items for loss prevention purposes and go back and get 3 more. It all occurs right for you there. You're going to be able to do this someday in your home. There are now being testing, beta testing, iPhones being able to do it. It's a little rough, but they're testing that type of approach. And think about the impact that has. Today, 30% of items that are purchased online are returned. If you can cut into that, think what it does and how it changes the business plans for UPS and FedEx and the amount of trackage and packages they carry. It's going to negatively impact their business and force them to adjust. You're not certain about a certain item, like a chair or a table, it's no problem. Take a picture of your room, send it to an app and see how the chair looks. Or take a panoramic photograph of the room in question, upload it, and arrange your entire room on your iPhone or iPad, full of furniture. Pick out the patterns, the selection of lighting, the coloring on the wall. You can do that. Need help with a product? Simply ask a digital assistant with whom you can share your screen selections or more general questions. No more guessing, no more hunting down a salesperson, no more having a salesperson following you and feeling like you're a little bit like you're being stalked. Although they're just there to help. But someone who's available to you whenever you want them. 1 o'clock in the morning, they're there. And the changes that are occurring in artificial intelligence will move that service along at ways we can't even imagine. They will be able to anticipate what you want, or what color you might want, or what variations you might want. Checkouts are just around the corner that you go in, you pile your items in your cart, and you don't even break stride as you walk out to your door and you're paid because it is linked to your form of payment and you're out the door and on your way. Technology has also substantially lowered the investment needed to become a retailer, which further challenges traditional brick and mortar retailer in terms of competitors. The barriers to the entry to the marketplace have never been lower. Entrepreneurs, particularly younger entrepreneurs, are launching businesses on social media, including Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat. No investment in storefront, little investment in inventory. They can just order it on demand when they need it. All of this is challenging traditional retailers. One uncomfortable result, which gets us back to store closings, is significantly less tolerance for marginal stores. It used to be that chains in particular had some tolerance for a location or a number of locations to operate at or below their profit margin. Those days are gone. If you had said to me 10 years ago that a CVS or Walgreens would close a store, I would have laughed at you. Today, within the last year, they've each closed a couple hundred of them. Traditional brick and mortar need that capital to invest in the technological changes that I've been describing and that they need to compete in this technological world. It's also led to the changes in malls, particularly indoor malls, and I realize this is a sensitive subject given the condition of one of the malls here in town. But are malls dead? And I'm going to argue no. They, like all of us, are going to have to change in this space. They are not going to be as they once were. They're going to be repurposed. They're going to have to be far more engaging and interactive, just as brick and mortar is going to be with the consumer. The consumer doesn't just want the selection, the demand, the customized offerings. They want to be entertained, and they want interaction. And malls are going to have to provide that as well. And they're experimenting now with bowling alleys, movie theaters. But they're also going to get into non-traditional mall stores. Some malls are starting to attract grocery stores. 5 years ago, that would have been unthinkable. Nobody wanted a grocery store in a mall. Now they want grocery stores in malls. Malls are looking at becoming medical offices, schools being repurposed in that fashion, residences, government offices, or some combination thereof. They might very well become a center for mixed living. But they're not dead. I always thought and continue to believe that history is somewhat circular. Things keep coming around, common themes keep happening, but you're always going forward. But think about what I referenced a little bit today. Pop-up stores and stores on wheels, they aren't much different from the covered wagons or door-to-door sales. They're just a different means of doing it. Loyalty cards and apps are the same idea. It's just a different delivery method. It's a back-to-the-future approach, and I think we're seeing that in retail to the point that things are almost coming full circle. Additional proof to this point comes from the fact that traditional brick-and-mortar retailers are feverishly working to incorporate technology into their selling techniques, the same technology that remote sellers use. But at the same time, remote sellers are trying to figure out how to incorporate brick-and-mortar storefronts into what they do best. Amazon is experimenting in Seattle with grocery stores. Amazon is opening bookstores. There is a value there. There's at some point that they both meet, or they wouldn't be looking at it, right? Brick-and-mortar isn't dead.
That's Illinois Retail Merchants Association CEO Rob Karp. He says it's easy to lose perspective. Online sales were 8.3% of total retail last year in the U.S. Karp says in a decade, though, various growth projections have online commerce amounting to between 21% and 32% of total retail sales. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This week marks the century anniversary of the U.S. entry into World War I. As what was once known as the Great War began to unfold 3 years earlier, a group of Bloomington Normal residents touring the continent had trouble leaving to get home. In this encore episode of the occasional GLT series McHistory, we hear an account of being marooned in Switzerland as the misnamed War to End All Wars spread across Europe.
It has been almost 2 weeks since I last wrote you, but I decided it was a waste of energy to write as absolutely no mail has gone out of the country since this horrid old war began. I'm Amelia Hill, Development Assistant at the McLean County Museum of History.
Louise Evans was born in 1893 in Bloomington, the only child of J. Fremont Evans, her father, and Clara Harwood Evans.
Goodbye. God bless you is all that I can say.
I am Bill Kemp, librarian of the McLean County Museum of History.
They say things are beginning to go through now, although we have not had a word from America for ages.
In the spring and early summer of 1914, Louise is on the so-called Grand Tour. A lot of wealthy upper middle class Americans in the late 19th and early 20th century took such a grand tour to visit places such as Rome and Athens and Vienna, picturesque Europe, classical Europe.
It seems positively months since I got your last letter. This war has entirely disarranged our plans, and I'm thinking seriously of coming home.
Louise's father was the senior member of a successful contracting business in Bloomington, the J.W. Evans Sons Company. They were involved in the construction of many prominent buildings in Bloomington, and the Evans Company also constructed several of the large, significant buildings on the state fairgrounds in Springfield.
At present, there are reported to be 200,000 Americans in Europe waiting to get home. The poor American consuls more than have their hands full, and all they can say is, stay where you are for the present.
She is actually traveling with Dora Graham, the wife of a McLean County Coal Company executive. So when war breaks out, Louise Evans and her companion are in Switzerland. She's attending a girls' boarding school, and there she hooks up with the family of Illinois Wesleyan University professor Wilbert Ferguson, his wife Mary, and their daughter Constance.
There are scads of people who have not a cent of currency. They will not cash letters of credit. You will realize how the banks are hanging on to currency when I tell you that although Mr. Ferguson has a lot in the bank, they will give him but $10 per week, and that for four people. You would die to see us economizing. We are afraid to spend a penny that we do not simply have to. But we really have lots of fun out of it all and are a million times better off than most people as we have our cute little apartment.
Pack all your troubles in your old kit bag and pile, pile, pile. Wind you the lucifer to light your fire.
This excerpt really speaks to the age of letter writing when family members wrote lengthy and very illiterate letters to each other. And oftentimes, if personal letters had news items or news of worthiness in them, the family member would take that letter to the pantograph and have it published in the paper as an open letter. And that's what we have here.
Who could have imagined when I came over that all this was going to happen? But really, it is an awful interesting experience, and I have so many things to write. I expect that so far as actual events of the war are concerned, you know more about it over there than we do here in the midst of it.
In the family, especially with the women, there was intelligence. These were smart, strong-willed women, but they were also very playful, and I think you get that with this Louise Evans letter.
The papers are afraid to print the news here, and everything is so quiet and peaceful that one can hardly realize that the war is not a dream. Of course, the soldiers are guarding the frontier, and we've had a chance to see a lot of them. Last Sunday, I went to a military service where there were 500 soldiers, and it was most interesting.
Goodbye, good luck, God bless you, is all that I can say.
We also have excerpts in the collections of the McLean County Museum of History of the notes she took during her grand tour. She writes of seeing trainloads of young boys ages 15 and ages 16 crowded like so many cattle on freight cars heading to the front, and this was her description of French troops. U.S. government actually organizes evacuation efforts for American nationals, and what they do is charter special trains that run all the way through France to the coast, and then these American nationals board ocean liners and travel on steerage back to the United States.
By the sea, by the sea, by the beautiful sea, you and I, oh how happy we'll be.
Mr. Ferguson wants to return as soon as he can get passage.
And just as she's boarding, one of the great battles of World War I is underway. That's the Battle of the Marne. That's where the Allies halt the German advance onto Paris. So in many ways, Louise got out just in time.
In Flanders field, the poppies grow. The poppies grow.
When she arrived in New York City, on September 13th, Mont, her father, said, "I am the happiest man in the country."
I doubt very much whether you will get this, so I will write no more. This will let you know that I am well. The Fergusons send love, and please give mine to all relatives and friends.
Roses are shining in Picardy, in the hush of the silver dew. Roses are flowering in Picardy, but there's never a rose like you.
Louise Evans married a World War I Army aviator from Bloomington. They later moved to Texas. She died in 1970. McHistory is a co-production of GLT and the McLean County Museum of History, using the letters, diaries, and voices of days gone by. This episode included the voices of librarian Bill Kemp and development assistant Amelia Hill. Most years around this time, we'd be in fund drive mode here at GLT, interrupting programs to ask for your financial support. Not this time around, though. You've let us know how much you like the less fund drive, more GLT concept we introduced last spring, so we're sticking with it. Instead of taking time away from the programs you depend on to ask for your help, we're only asking in regular station breaks like this one. But we're still counting on you to hold up your end of the bargain. Renew your annual support or make your first-time contribution now at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Find the interviews and stories heard today at our website. Thanks to Colleen Reynolds and the McLean County Museum of History for today's show. You can also find the full Sound Ideas podcast at WGLT.org. This is GLT and WGLT.org.